We do have a quorum sitting at the table. Today we're going to be doing overviews, first of the DHS-based budget, forecasted programs and some of the trends, and then get into more detail about the explanation of the DHS-based budget by program area. We intend to save time for some members' questions and have this a good conversation to give us a good base and framework to have conversations. I think that it's well understood that we are going to have a lot of work and a lot of attention this session, and I really look forward to working with all of the members and all of the entire healthcare community to do our very best in this important area. A couple of things. I know we have the majority of the members here, but maybe when your neighbors come, a couple of just housekeeping items that staff has asked me to go over. These are your committee. We have a lot of freshmen. These are your committee folders, and they should really stay at the committee table when you leave. Inside the folders, you will find a subfolder that's a folder for items that you wish to save. If you find things that you believe are of interest to you and you want to hang on to those, you need to put them in that save folder. Everything else in the folder will be recycled when it's collected by staff. And so that's just some housekeeping things important to keep in mind, because we do wind up going through a lot of paper in this committee, unfortunately. Someday we'll get around to more electronic work. And then also, just a really good reminder, always, this room, the acoustics are pretty good, but we'll be meeting in 123 a lot of times. Microphones throughout the whole Capitol, be careful, they're off and on. So if the committee shuts down or something, no, really, if the committee shuts down, don't assume that the microphones are off. I've been caught talking, and it's broadcast out in the hall and things like that. So just push your chair back. Just be cognizant that microphones may or may not be live at any given time, and that's just a good practice. And so, and then one other note. We do have a concurrent tax and finance joint committee meeting downstairs right now. And at 10, they're going to move up to room 123 and have just a finance committee meeting. And I will need to be stepping out to go work in finance for a little while. So we're starting with the hectic schedule right away. But with that, I will invite DHS Commissioner Lucinda Jessen to the table, and we'll start with the overview of the base budget and the forecasted programs and some of the trends we might be looking at. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's great to be here with you all this morning. I'm just going to say a few words of overview about our budget. They'll be followed by Chuck Johnson, George Hoffman, and some of our assistant commissioners who will talk in more detail. And I believe you probably have in front of you kind of a human services budget overview, and I will be referring to this from time to time in just my opening remarks. I think I listed on the front page our basic mission at DHS, which is to provide essential services to Minnesota's most vulnerable residents. But I wanted to start out this budget overview by talking a little bit about the people we serve, because I sometimes think with the human services budgets, it's easy to think of these programs as serving other people. But, you know, as the slides note, our programs touch over a million Minnesotans every year. You know, people like me, or at least several years ago like me, when I was looking for childcare for my four children, to the over half a million Minnesotans this year who are relying, many of them working families, on our SNAP program for food assistance, to the many people, over 800,000 of them just this year, who rely on our health care benefits. I mean, these are programs, if you think about programs that touch a million people every year, and we have 5.3 people living in Minnesota, it's hard to be a family and not at some point in your life be affected by the programs that we're going to be talking about here today. I think in the slides I just tried to talk about some of the major populations that we serve, especially starting with children. You know, so many of our programs help support children, especially poor children and vulnerable children. We pay for health care for over 400,000 children every year. We pay for, and this was one of the things that surprised me in this job, the extent of, we pay for almost half of the births in Minnesota, which gives us at DHS and through the funding really that opportunity to help start children off in the best way possible in their life. I think the last figure we had was 42% of Minnesota's births are paid for through our programs. We help about 42,000 families every year through economic assistance, and we pay for child care assistance for over 35,000 children every month. And if you go to the next page and we talk about kind of the next large group of people that our programs serve, and those are seniors. We pay for health care for about 65,000 Minnesota seniors. If you think about our long-term care programs, you know, Medicaid pays for close to half, about 44% of nursing home care in our state. So when we think about those vulnerable citizens and those important outreach, you can start to see why seniors are such an important part of the reasons for our programs. Yeah, Minnesota has so much to be proud of in a lot of areas, but particularly in our long-term care programs. Just last year, we were rated the number one state in the country when it comes to providing home and community-based services for seniors and people with disabilities. You know, and that's not just saying, oh, well, Minnesota, they spend a lot of money. They ranked us in terms of, you know, the cost effectiveness, the quality, and the access to our long-term care programs, especially the programs that help keep people in their homes and communities. So when you hear about our budget, you'll hear a lot about what we're doing. And you'll also hear about our Reform 2020 initiative, which was a result of bipartisan legislation in 2011, which directed the department to go back and redesign and propose to the federal government a redesign of our home and community-based services. Not because we're doing badly, we were just ranked number one in the country, but because with the coming demographics, when you think about the DHS budget and the age wave that's going to hit us, we need to do more to provide more cost-effective long-term care services, to keep people in their homes and communities, to provide a greater array of services so that we help people earlier before they have to go on to some of our most expensive programs, and to be able to let them have some things that keep them in their homes without having to go in institutions or on one of our waivers. So you'll be hearing more about that. And turning to the next page, kind of the next large group of people that we serve are people with disabilities, you know, who bring so much to the community and to our state. And I point this out because when we think about this population, oftentimes, and those of you who are around this a lot for a long time know this better than I do, you know, we think of health care and our role in providing health care for people with disabilities. But as you'll learn looking at thinking about our budget, we also provide important work in employment, in training, and in housing. Because it's not just health care, but it's often the housing and the employment that helps keep people with disabilities as independent as possible in their homes, and connected with, and often with very important employment that they work on. So it's not just about health care. If you turn to the next page and you look at our total state operating budget, it's in many ways a sobering pie chart. And this shows you in our current operating budget the proportion that Health and Human Services takes up of our overall state budget. Now, a lot of this, of course, is paid by federal funding, and our Chief Operating Officer and Chief Financial Officer Chuck Johnson has some charts he'll go through with you after I talk and explain the breakdown. How many of these dollars are federal dollars? For an example, the federal government pays about half of our Medicaid program, but they also provide a lot of the dollars that flow through DHS for chemical dependency and our mental health programs and some other things as well. But still, when you look at this, you'll see the large role Health and Human Services plays, the challenges before you, certainly in this committee. But I also think that this slide drives home the point that we really need to look at what we can do to make our programs more sustainable in the future while we continue to provide the really just critical services that we do. Turning to the next slide, as I said, this is really a high overview here, but this really looks at where do we spend those dollars at DHS. And as you will see looking at this, the vast majority of this is spent on healthcare. we'll give you more details in the breakdown, but I just want to point out a few things in this slide. While, you know, so often those outside the world of Health and Human Services think of DHS in that traditional role as being the welfare agency, we spend 11% of our budget on what would be thought of as traditional cash assistance and other social service programs. So while that's an important part of the work we do, from a matter of the budget, it is a relatively small part of our budget. Sex offender treatment program, another high-profile activity we have at DHS, and one that is growing, but is 1.1% of our overall budget. And I'd also like to point out that we spend less than 3% of our budget on administration. I think we can talk more about that a little bit later. And when we talk about health care, if you turn to the next slide, so much of that is spent through our Medicaid program. And the next slide is very high level, but I think it just drives home the point. If you look at who's enrolled in our Medicaid program, most of the people who enrolled are children and families. Those over 400,000 children I talked about, so that make up, you know, more than half of our Medicaid enrollees are children. 16% of our Medicaid enrollment are people with disabilities. But if you look at how our dollars are spent, 44% are spent on people with disabilities, and you know, a relatively small proportion, considering their enrollment numbers, on children and parents. And also points out that while seniors are only 7.8% of our enrollment, those kind of people we think of as dual eligibles, we spend more than twice as much on them when we look at the expenditure side. And if you look at the last slide in our overview packet on spending trend, this is a simplistic approach, but I just wanted to say a few words about kind of where we're headed, you know, in our state for DHS spending and how we get there. It's challenging because when times are the toughest, when need is the greatest, the demand for our services increases. They would call this a counter-cyclical program. But let me just kind of try and make this real when I looked at the charts over the last 2 years since I've been commissioner. Since the beginning of the recession in 2008, we've seen growth in our children's and families program of 25%. 140,000 more people turning to our Medicaid program in the children's and family category than were on it before because of the recession. And I'm doing the comparison with children's and families because, as you know, there was an early expansion in our state. They expanded Medicaid to single adults up to 75% of the poverty level. So this comparison is not looking at the single adults. So I'm just doing very much an apples-to-apples comparison here. Children's and family, having 140,000 more of them on our programs in 2011, you know, later in that year, than we did at the beginning of the recession. And it's not because we made the programs easier to get onto. You know, there are still, as we know, a lot of people eligible for these programs that are not enrolled. You know, I was in Human Services. They had a time, I was out in Boston, where they brought together all the Human Services commissioners or their counterparts from all the different states. And, you know, I don't go to very many of these out-of-state things, but it was a really good opportunity, I thought, to learn from other states. And we had a good speaker. And this was in, I guess, towards the end of 2011. And he said to us that in these difficult times in the human services world, what we have to learn to do is to serve 25% more people. Or he said, actually, we need to serve 20% more people with 20% fewer staff. And so I went back and looked at our numbers. And what I found was, yes, just on this apples-to-apples comparison, we're serving 25% more people in our Medicaid program. And when you look at our staffing, we have, from comparing 2008 staffing at DHS to where we are today, and I've taken out I haven't included kind of this, the Minnesota, the Minute employees, so I'm doing an apples-to-apples comparison. We have 1,000 fewer employees at DHS than we did. And I'm not saying that in a complaining way. I'm really just, it just makes real to me the challenges that we have with our Medicaid program particularly, but all of our programs, when times are tough, when state budgets are just very difficult to deal with, that's when people need our programs more. And that's what we really have been dealing with. I think most of you know that in the 2012-13 biennial budget, DHS cut $1 billion from projected spending and $1.7 billion in the fiscal year 14 and 15 tails. It would be an understatement to say, that this included painful service cuts to many Minnesotans and the providers that take care of them. I would say that there were some of these reductions that were positive reforms, you know, that I was proud to be part of and that moved Minnesota forward, such as the managed care contracting reforms and such as the direction to really go and redesign our home and community-based services and kind of embark on Reform 2020. But I do think that that is a backdrop that we have to be cognizant of as we start to look at this biennial budget. And with that, Mr. Chair, members, I'm happy to answer questions, and I have lots of people here to follow me and provide you with a lot more detail about our budget.
Yeah, I'll follow up on the last point that you made about the $1 billion in reductions. That's general fund only. A lot of the work we were doing was in all funds budget, and to put it in context, we did have serious financial and budgetary issues to go through in the last biennium, and in the final deal that was signed into law, there was $1.8 billion in cuts across the entire state budget, and this $1 billion is the HHS share of the budget cuts, and so that is a really critical point to understand. I always say, you know, HHS has been doing the lion's share of the budget balancing around this place through all of these years that we have been working in deficit situations, and it's becoming more and more difficult to accommodate those difficult targets. So thank you for your presentation. Yes, Senator Kiffmeyer. I just about called you representative. We'll get used to this.
I know, Senator Laurie. We worked on conference committees together.
Yes.
And the House, Senate, so appreciate that. But I just had a clarification, Commissioner. Good to see you again as well. Nice to see familiar faces in this particular committee. But in regards to the $1 billion, it says here from the projected budget, can you give me the actual dollar amount from one budget to the next? So I kind of get that in perspective a little more.
Commissioner Jessen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, I can't, as I sit here right today, give you that exact dollar amount, but I must say it's made difficult just because of the changes in federal funding. You know, as I know you're aware, Senator, we had some kind of one-time federal funding that, as a result of kind of this ARRA funding, which supplemented the Medicaid program and gave us a one-time increase in our FFP. And then the state had to kind of basically, once that ended, step in and increase, kind of make up for that to continue on. So comparing between 2010 and 11 and 12-13, because of just these wide variations in federal funding, is difficult. But so that's why when I looked at it from just the projected budget, you know, the forecasted budget and the cuts we had to make from that. But I'm happy to, you know, Chuck Johnson, who's following me, George Hoffman may have better sense of those numbers.
Right.
And I'm also happy to go back and try and, you know, get those to you. But as I said, just because of the variations in federal funding, hard to do apples to apples.
Mr. Chairman, if I could follow.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I find that is a challenging kind of a thing to do, but whenever you have a projected budget, that's a big difference. I know that in a previous office, there was a big difference between a cut that meant less than the 2 years before or a cut from a projected budget. So one was hope for increase and you didn't get it, and then the other one was an actual cut from the previous year's budget. But I know this particular department has so many variables that can be a little bit difficult, but then we also have a finite number here too. So I just wanted to try and help a little bit and put that in context.
Yes. You know, I mean, an increase, and it is something that we talk about a great deal, but it's important to also understand that when we talk about increases in the Health and Human Services budget, a lot of the, you know, additional spending that gets added to our budget is for demographic changes. I mean, we are living longer. We are in a world where, you know, scientific advances in healthcare are coming, and healthcare spending is growing across the nation, and we have people that we're able to support longer and longer in their lives, and these demographic changes come to us. We have more and more people, particularly in an economic downturn. I think that was the other point. We set thresholds. If you fall below a threshold of poverty, you know, we have a social safety net there for you. And so that's where we see the 25% increase just through the economic downturn on our Medicaid programs. And that's why, you know, the forecasted numbers are very, very important to the people that we serve. And then, you know, when we experience that growth through the levels that we put in our state statute, at which point we've said you're eligible for assistance, and then we cut from that, it does make a real difference in people's lives. And so I know that that's an area that we spend a lot of time talking on about, but it is important to understand that these are real cuts that make a real difference in people's lives, and they are a reduction in the promises that we had made prior to that time. So, I mean, forecast is a good piece. You'll see from slide 7, almost everything we do is forecasted. 9 million of the 12 or 13 or billion rather is in forecasted programs, which is the level of support the people of Minnesota have come to expect from what we've enacted here. So that's kind of where it is. And with that, you were going to invite Chuck Johnson and George Hoffman next. Are they coming together or separate, or however it works best?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Committee.
I'm Chuck Johnson with the Department of Human Services. I'm the Chief Financial and Operating Officer for DHS. I'm going to give you, as Commissioner Jessen suggested, sort of just another step down level of exposure on our budget, and then George is going to give you a more analysis of where some of the spending trends are taking us. I'm going to work off of this sheet. You should have this in your packet. You might need your glasses for this one. It's a little bit smaller. This is the detailed breakdown of DHS's budget by budget activity. Part of why I want to walk you through this and have you understand it is over the next couple of days, as the program areas come up and the assistant commissioners are presenting what the programs do and where those budgets are, this will be a handy sheet to refer back to see what they're talking about in terms of what the dollar numbers are and which budget activities those dollars sit in. Excuse me. What you have on this sheet is the shaded column is the current budget that sits out there for 14-15, the next biennium, which is the budget you'll be working on this year to finalize and make appropriations on. This is how it currently sits in the base with the November forecast. The column next to it on the right shows the federal funding that comes along with those general fund appropriations, so it gives you sort of both sides of that equation. And if you go down to the bottom, you'll see that the bottom line number of $12.8 million ties out to the pie chart that Commissioner Jessen shared with you. And you also see that the federal spending that we're projecting for 14-15 is about $14.4 billion. That's usually, in the past, we've had those numbers match a little bit closer. It's been around a half-half. What you're seeing here with the increased federal share is really the result of the current forecast holding the 100% federal reimbursement for the expansion of adults without children, currently up to 75% of poverty, as we did in 2011. So that's really what accounts for that bump in federal funding. Our budget is organized into several categories. You see these on the left-hand side with the bolded headings. The central office, which is essentially the administrative accounts. This pays for that 2.2% that the commissioner identified for staff and operations in central office. the forecasted programs, which Mr. Hoffman will talk more about, you can see that that's really where the bulk of the money is. $11 billion out of the $12.8 billion is in our forecasted programs. And again, you'll jump right out and see that medical assistance, almost $9 billion, is the big elephant in that area as well. As the commissioner said, most of our spending goes into health care. The next category are grant programs. The difference between forecasted programs and grant programs is that forecasted programs are, as the name implies, forecasted by the department based on, and George Hoffman can tell you more about this, based on essentially a number of factors dealing with what's going on in the economy, what we're seeing in caseload trends, expenditure trends in the programs. Because of the complexity of these programs, which are largely open-ended programs in terms of enrollment based on people who are eligible, we forecast them and give you our best estimate of what the cost is going to be for the next year. And if you want to then change that cost up or down, you need to actually change levers within the program. You can't just say, well, we want you to spend $5 million less. You need to reduce eligibility or increase eligibility. You need to address benefits and what benefits are provided, or you need to look at the rates that are paid to individuals.
I'm sorry, I thought you had a question.
Well, I guess I do. I mean, as I go through this grant programs, the Children and Economic Support Grants with a new $1 billion of federal there jumps right out at me anyway. I was just wondering what that supports. And what
Mr. Chair, that is the SNAP program, Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, what we used to call food stamps.
Yep.
And so it's kind of a funny one because it's a very large program. It is an open-ended entitlement, but it's completely federally funded. So it just shows here under our grant programs because that's where we put the money as we pass it through to the individuals we pay those benefits to.
Yep. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regard to the SNAP program, was obviously it's federally managed, so was that a change in eligibility or a change in need in the state or a combination of the two?
Well, I think I might have mischaracterized that as new. I don't
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, that's correct. It's not a new expenditure. This is just our projected expenditure in SNAP for the next biennium. It's not necessarily an increase, although the SNAP program has been increasing, enrollment has been increasing in that program over time. And I don't have those numbers with me, but we could show you what that increase has looked
like.
But
this is just a program that has historically been on our books, and it is a largely federal program with little state support to finance it. Senator Benson,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And it would be nice at some point to have a side-by-side with current budget to compare with forecast. I know that was one of my biggest challenges to get up to speed on what's happening.
I believe a good piece of that is on the next page.
It is, okay.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. And I'll keep you on this page just for a minute to highlight a few other things before we go to the next page. As the Chair suggested, the grant programs, the only one that's a little bit funny there is the one that we talked about, which includes the SNAP programs. Most of these are really services that are contracted by the department, allocations that are made to the county, that are fixed appropriations. We provide funding to nonprofits, other community partners, to counties to provide some of the wraparound services for the populations, children, people with disabilities or seniors, some of the case management and other pieces that support the direct payments that are made through either health care to individuals in the forecasted program. So it's kind of the complementary piece to our service package. And then toward the bottom, you'll see state-operated services. We have three functions there, appropriated services for mental health. This is the new behavioral health hospitals that have been running for about 4 or 5 years now. We also have enterprise services within state-operated services. You'll see there's no appropriation there. These are services that are self-supporting based on payments that are made by Medicaid, Medicare, or private payers for services to people with disabilities, treatment for people with chemical dependency, and so forth. And then the security hospital in St. Peter, which provides forensic services to people who are committed as mentally ill and dangerous. The sex offender program toward the bottom as well, the commissioner addressed. This goes to serve the sex offenders. About three-quarters of this money goes into the staff that staff those programs. And then technical activities, which is largely just an accounting function of where funds pass through for various purposes within how we account for the dollars, particularly pass-throughs to counties and so forth. Mr. Chair, then I would turn to the next page. Uh, You'll see again the shaded column is the 14-15 biennial budget, which you're looking at this year for the appropriation they're making for this year. The column that's now been added to the left shows a 12-13 budget. This starts to get at the questions both from Senator Kiffmeyer and Senator Benson. These are the appropriations from the previous biennium. And again, I'm not going to try to address all the changes. Mr. Hoffman will talk in some detail about the changes in forecasted programs. I'll just highlight a few things here. Within the operations area, again, this is our operational budget. As background, one of the big changes in this area over the last couple of years has been the transfer of our IT services, or all agencies' IT services, to Minute Services, formerly known as OET. In 2011, the legislature passed a law that centralizes IT across all state government in the Minute Department. That had some impact on how we shifted dollars around, which account for a little bit, I think, of some of the reductions that you see here. But also there were some one-time appropriations in 12-13 that have run out, which accounts for a little bit why you see a lower number there, as well as some budget reductions that were made. Within the forecasted programs, I'll just, as I said, Mr. Hoffman will talk more about this, but I'll just highlight a couple of things. You'll see that MinnesotaCare shows this 67.7% increase. This is really a matter of the forecast and the assumptions in the forecast. It could be termed somewhat artificial. Currently, for adults without children who have incomes between 75% and 200% of poverty, they're eligible for MinnesotaCare. We get a federal match of 50% on those expenditures. That's under a waiver with the federal government, meaning they've approved a special circumstance where they provide 50% for this population. That waiver runs out at the end of calendar year 13. So the forecast assumes these folks are continuing MinnesotaCare, and we, as a state, will have to pay 100% of the cost of that. That's likely not to be the result after we work on the Affordable Care Act reforms and think about how coverage plays out, expansion of Medicaid and other options. But it's what sits in the forecast right now, so it's a somewhat artificial-looking increase.
This is a critical piece. I'll just repeat what Chuck Johnson said, that this is all based on current law. It's an issue that we'll be working through this entire session. What are we going to do with the MinnesotaCare population? How are we going to implement exchanges? What do we do for supports of these people? If we did absolutely nothing, the federal waiver that we are currently under, operating MinnesotaCare under, that brings in some federal financial participation goes away. So current law in 2014, if we did nothing and just kept the MinnesotaCare program, we would see that federal support disappear. And so this entire sheet is all based on current law if we did nothing, and it is intended just to give us a foundation upon which to think. So when we go back to it, it's really critical to keep that in our heads, and it's difficult at times, but I think it's valuable to have this as a framework. So continue.
Mr. Chair, under the grant programs, there's also a couple of numbers that kind of jump out. Child care development grants, it's a relatively small area, but you see the 96% increase. That's actually because there were some one-time reductions made to that appropriation in the 12-13 biennium. The base is restored in 14-15. So it's kind of just jumping back to the original base.
So if we had looked at the previous biennium, we'd see that the 12-13 is just lower than historic.
That's correct, yep. Mr. Chair. In the aging and adult services grant, you'll see again there appears to be a large increase there. Again, that was due to some one-time reductions that were made in 12-13. This was related to a fairly complex proposal that was passed, I believe, in 2009 called Nursing Facility Level of Care, which was an effort to really try to better target how we provide long-term care services based on need. And as part of that, the legislature created some grants in this account called Essential Community Support Grants to provide some support to people who wouldn't be eligible for nursing facility level of care anymore. We weren't able to implement that when we wanted to because of a maintenance of effort under the federal law. So when we delayed the implementation, we took these grants out of the budget because we didn't need to have them in there anymore. That will be implemented starting in 2014, and so those grants are back in the budget in 14-15. And that accounts for the large chunk of the difference that you see in that account. And then there's also what appears to be a large reduction in disability grants. That's actually, again, artificial. There's a piece of the disability grants activity that actually is transferred from the medical assistance account. That transfer doesn't happen prior to the biennium starting, so right now the account looks lower, but once that transfer is made, it'll roughly be in the same territory as the appropriations for disability grants were in 12 and 13. Mr. Chair, I think that I'm going to stop there and have Mr. Hoffman pick up a more detailed examination of the forecasted programs, unless there are other questions for me.
Any questions from Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, the alternative care 27% increase, if you could just explain that a little bit.
That's up in the forecasted that George is going to cover. So maybe, I think, right, that's what we're going to dive into right now with Mr. Hoffman.
That's correct. Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, and George can correct me if I'm wrong. I'll start out. My understanding is that the way we forecast alternative care is essentially a forecast that's higher than what the usual spending is, and then whatever the excess that's left there is transferred back to the medical assistance account. It's just a way that we try to deal with some of the uncertainty around how much alternative care spending will go on and some of the mechanics of making that spending happen. Mm-hmm. So it usually shows up as being what you're looking at in the column for 12-13 is the actual spending of $71 million. What you're looking at in the column for 14-15 is the appropriation. The appropriation in 12-13 was probably similar to something like $90 million, but the actual spending ended up lower. The difference is transferred to the medical assistance account.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, it's actually about a $30 million a year program, and the balance of that cancels back to the medical assistance account, and we subtract it from the medical assistance forecast. Part of that has happened in the 12-13 biennium, and so about $20 million has been subtracted because in fiscal 12 it canceled back, but the appropriation level is about $45 or $46 million a year. So it's actual activity in FY12 has brought down the FY12-13 number.
And there's anticipated to be a further transfer as we finish up the biennium, as we continue to work through it? Is that
what's effectively budgeted in 14 and 15? For the biennium is about $35 million going back to the medical assistance account. And so we forecast $35 million less of spending in medical assistance, which will come out of this alternative care appropriation.
Can you why would be my obvious question? I mean, I'm
we had a problem some 20 years ago with the appropriation for alternative care being cut because the forecast went down. And for a number of bienniums each year, we had to ask for more for alternative care and say it's going to save a certain amount of money in medical assistance. We did some major changes in alternative care in 2005, 2006 that made the program much less expensive. But the appropriation stayed at a higher level than needed. Because this mechanism was in place where what we expected to be left over was offset against the medical assistance program. So it's a complication that annoys a lot of people, Mr. Chair. But effectively what is budgeted for the program is about $30 million a year, and that is practically unchanged across the 12-13, 14-15 biennium.
Okay. Well, maybe we can get behind that before we're done with this biennium.
We could, We could reduce the appropriation some, but nobody's been in a hurry to do that because it doesn't save any money.
Right.
We could make the difference smaller, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other questions on that? I mean, and with that, okay, the rest of the forecasted programs, Mr. Hoffman?
I'm George Hoffman from the Department of Human Services. I'm in charge of the reports and forecast division. We forecast caseloads and expenditures in the medical programs and in the cash assistance programs. I'm going to run through first a little bit of background on these programs and the terminology, and then I'm going to run through some of the major elements of spending in medical assistance and the other programs and show you a 10-year history of what the total spending has been.
Members do have in their packet a basic terminology. Are we going to kind of be going through that? Is that what you're
telling us? That's the correct document, Mr. Chair. Medicaid is the federal name of the federal and state program, federal and state means-tested program that pays for medical care. This is a very complex program because the federal government basically says to states, if you will have a Medicaid program, we will help fund your program on certain terms. And then those terms are extremely complicated. They involve certain minimum coverages and a lot of procedural requirements that allow each state to have a somewhat different program, hence the complexity of the thing, because within the federal rules, each state has a fairly wide range of choices for what it does in its program. Now, Medicare is a strictly federal program. It is not means tested. It covers mostly elderly people. A very large majority of the elderly people in the country are covered by Medicare. There are technical and citizenship reasons why some are not covered. In Minnesota, more than 95% of people over the age of 65 are covered by Medicare. Medicare also covers disabled people meeting certain requirements. A medical assistance is the state's name for its Medicaid program. We also use federal Medicaid funding in the Minnesota Care program. And actually, currently, a very high percentage of the people in the Minnesota Care program are also drawing federal funding on them. And the federal funding, when we get it for the Minnesota Care program, is generally at the same 50-50 matching as we get in the medical assistance program. The state started the Minnesota Care program in 1992 in order to cover uninsured individuals above the limits of the medical assistance and then general assistance medical care programs. We got federal funding piecemeal for various parts of the population of the Minnesota Care program over the years beginning in 1995. And we finally temporarily got to the point where we've got federal funding for almost all the people in the program. Now, we talk about different groups of people in medical assistance because the eligibility for a Medicaid program, and ours is called medical assistance, has been categorical from the start. Since the Medicaid program was founded in the 60s, in order to be eligible in Minnesota for medical assistance, you had to fit into one of a number of categories. And those categories are over age 65, disabled or blind, according to the definition of the Supplemental Security Income Program, a child. In the federal program, it's under age 19. That's the mandatory level. Minnesota has opted to cover children under 21. You have to be a parent or a custodial parent or the custodial caretaker of a child under 21 or a pregnant woman. Now, the group excluded from that list of categories is non-elderly, non-disabled adults who are not the custodial parent of a child. That was the group that was left out of the Medicaid program at the start, and that was the reason why Minnesota had a general assistance medical care program. That was the group that was covered by the general assistance medical care program. Some states covered that group, some states did not. We also went further, Minnesota went further in covering that group when it added coverage of adults without children in the Minnesota Care Program up to higher income levels than what was covered by the General Assistance Medical Care Program. The recent expansion of coverage for adults without children adds coverage in the medical assistance program for that group of adults without children who were formerly in the state's general assistance medical care program. And they are covered up to 75% of the poverty level. That is a lower level than the coverage of parents, which is up to 100% of the poverty level, and it's a lower level than the coverage of most children age 2 and plus, which is up to 150% of the poverty level. The Medicaid program, after the changes in law that occurred in the Affordable Care Act, offers states the option to expand coverage of adults without children up to 138% of the poverty level. The law also offered states an early expansion option, which Minnesota took. This option to cover up to 138 of poverty is effective January 1st, 2014. Minnesota opted to do early expansion of this group up to 75% of poverty. There are now issues. The federal government for the years 14, 15, and 16 offers 100% federal funding for this expansion group. It is not clear, and CMS has said some things suggesting that it will not give us 100% federal funding for a partial expansion that does not go all the way up to 138. We had discussions of this in the administration, and the forecast still assumes that we can get 100% federal funding on the current coverage up to 75% of poverty. But there is a clear risk if the state doesn't adopt the full expansion, it's not clear how much federal funding we will get on the partial expansion of adults without children. 138, I just said up to 138% of poverty. The nominal level of coverage is 133 of poverty, 133% of poverty. But the ACA also recovers also requires a disregard of 5% of income, and so the effective required coverage is 133 plus 5. And in our forecast documentation, I've taken to labeling this 138% parenthesis nominal 133. So you'll see variously 133 or 138. It's all talking about the same thing.
Let me stop you and just back up one point. Regarding the expansion to 138 is what I'll usually just call it. Sometimes I might slip up and say 133 if it's on a paper in front of me, but it's really 138 when it's all said and done. But the partial option of a partial expansion, I kind of heard you characterize it as we don't really know what federal funds would flow. And when I read what the feds say, it looks pretty clear to me that the enhanced federal funding of 100% for the first 3 years for the full expansion and then weaning down to 90% would come only if you do a full expansion. And the flip side of that would be otherwise it's 50% for whatever you cover. And it appears pretty clear to me. Maybe I could tease out from you where you find a little wiggle room of what the feds might support. I mean, or maybe I'm mishearing what you're saying.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sort of speaking in terms of what we knew up to the November forecast,
okay,
where CMS, I don't think yet, had taken any very strong position on it. But I would suggest that it's maybe also not clear that if we don't get 100, the legal position, as I understood it for the November forecast, is they might not give us anything at all on a partial expansion.
For a partial, right. Okay, so the
it was unclear. There was a good argument. There was a good legal argument. We would not qualify for 100, but anything other than that appeared to be at the discretion of CMS.
Okay. Good enough. Thank you for that clarification. That's helpful.
If you turn to page 3. I'll go through briefly the major spending pieces in the medical assistance program. What you have in front of you is a 10-year history of expenditures, of the total expenditures on the services. There's no administrative cost in here. This is just on the services. And it's the total dollars, state, federal, and there's some county dollars in there, too, though it's a pretty small piece. And this is to familiarize you with the relative size of these different pieces and of the trend in spending. So the first piece is long-term care facilities. This is mostly expenditures for nursing home care. And we currently pay for about 17,000 people in nursing homes, and about 15,000 of them are over the age of 65. And so in this case, the spending trend has been slightly negative, because the caseload in nursing, the MA caseload in nursing homes has been trending downward, and even with some modest increases in rates, we have a negative trend here. If you move to the next block, this is the spending on alternatives to institutional care, which we call long-term care waivers, and we call them waivers because each one of five of these arrangements that we have has to be negotiated with the federal government, and we have to justify under certain federal rules that we will spend no more per person on these alternative services than we would spend if that person were in the institutional setting. So the waiver is the special agreement that we have with the feds. Here we have an average growth trend in actual data and forecast. Part of the 10 years here, 3 years of the 10 is forecasted. We have growth of about 7.5%. We are currently serving about 56,000 people in these alternatives, and about half of the growth is driven by increasing cost of care, and about half over the 10 years is driven by increases in the number of people who are being covered. And then just so that you can see, because what's going on here is institutional costs are going down slightly, and the alternative to institutional long-term care cost is going up, we show you a sum of the two in the third column. And here the spending trend for the sum of the two is about 4.5% a year. From there, if you look down, MA, elderly and disabled basic care. This is the basic medical care coverage that we offer for the elderly and the disabled. For the elderly, currently about 55,000 individuals. We mostly act like a Medicare supplement because almost all of them are on Medicare. And what medical assistance spends is a supplement to the Medicare expenditure. The other part of the population, about 120,000 disabled enrollees currently, about half of them are on Medicare. So for half of them, we're a Medicare supplement. For the other half, we pay the total cost of their medical care. And what's in this category is everything we spend on them except long-term care services. So the same people who are getting long-term care services are also in this category of elderly and disabled basic care. The long-term care recipients are basically a subset of all the elderly and disabled covered by the medical assistance program. The next block to the right on the bottom of the page is families and children basic care. This includes coverage of pregnant women. The trend here has been 8.25% a year over the 10-year period. It's almost 60% caused by increasing enrollment. Enrollment went up with the poor economy starting in 2008. It had gone down a bit before that. It went up through fiscal 9, fiscal 10. It's roughly peaked in fiscal 11, leveled off. But we're forecasting further increase in enrollment with the implementation of federal health care reform, because that's going to mandate health care coverage for people, and so it's going to bring in more people who currently could be on our program but are not currently, but who we expect to be brought into the program by the health care by the coverage mandate.
So this is based on current law, partially at the federal level, that we have not yet come into compliance with. I'm looking at the 2014 projection that is.
This is based, we split out how we treated the effects of the federal changes, and the effect of the insurance mandate we put into the forecast. Other things where we need to change state law, and we're going to have to change the procedures for eligibility and enrollment, the effects of those changes are going to be budget issues and they are not included in the forecast.
Okay. But they are still requirements that they, we will have to...
They are still a requirement, but we treated them as budget items because they don't happen unless we...
Unless we act.
We change state law.
Yeah. Okay. Did everybody basically understand that? We're going to see a lot more numbers as we... work through this and do the compliance piece and look at various expansion populations. And these are going to be numbers we work on a lot in this committee. So continue.
If you turn to page 4 on the top, we have the brief history of the medical assistance coverage of adults without children. This coverage started in March of 2011. We show the percentage changes starting from fiscal year 12, which was the first year of coverage of this group. Most of the cost trend that we see and anticipate so far is a matter of increasing enrollment in this group.
Okay.
This is the group that we pulled 50,000 people out of the Minnesota Care Program and brought them into medical assistance, and we picked up what had been the population of the GAMC program, which was historically in the neighborhood of 30,000 people.
Okay.
Just a brief piece on the total of the Minnesota Care program. We have had ups and downs in enrollment in this program. We've also pulled people out of the program, as I just explained, into medical assistance. Overall cost trend on the total costs, without considering how much is federal or state, is about 5%. We currently have about 125,000 enrollees on this program. Two-thirds of them are children and parents. The cash assistance programs are on page 5. These again are.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Hayden.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Hoffman. Before you move on to the cash assistance payments, could you tell me where the emergency medical assistance program is in your projections here, your budget?
It's in the part on the families with children. It isn't broken out. It's a relatively small portion of the medical assistance program as a whole. In total dollars, it historically was in the neighborhood of $40 million a year. So it's an important piece, but it's a very small piece of the dollars in the medical assistance program.
So we're talking about that fourth block on page 3, the MA
yes.
Families and Kids
yes.
Basic
it's,
Care.
It's in there,
yeah.
But it amounts to roughly $40 million in recent years.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Hoffman, so I know we had some trouble with that and tried to do a fix, so we're confident that we spent about the same amount of money this past year as we've had historically.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hayden, there were limits placed on emergency medical assistance. Expenditures are down. In recent years, it was approaching $40 million. I can get you more accurate information. It's more, I think, currently more in the neighborhood of $30 million. But we can get you some history, including actual data for the last year after the cuts went into effect.
Yeah, that'll be great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for that. So then on to the cash assistance.
In the cash assistance programs, this is total expenditures, but there is federal money only in the MFIP program. Part of the cash payments in the MFIP program are federal. All of the payments in the other three cash programs come from the state. The spending trend in the MFIP program is practically zero. That's partly because FY 2005 was a pretty high post-recession year, and caseload what you see changing in the expenditures basically reflects changes in the participation in the program, in the number of families on the program. So the number of families fell in the late 07, 08, and then with the recession that started in 09, started back up again, and have kind of leveled off, and our forecast has them basically leveling off. General assistance, which pays a grant of $2,003 if you have no other income. A grant of $203 a month if you have no other income. This program also expenditures basically reflect what's happening to the caseload. And we have experienced a steadily increasing caseload over the years. We don't have a really good explanation for the dynamics of this, but it's what we see happening steadily. You'd think that we wouldn't have a growing population who could qualify for a $203 benefit, but that's what has been happening historically.
Okay. Senator Hayden?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hoffman, I know that in, I think, FY 10 and 11 are somewhere within those, in that biennium, there was an enhanced amount that the federal government gave us to help with the growing roles of the TANF program. Do you recall that, and can you talk about how that dynamic changed and if we're flat again?
Mr. Hoffman?
The MFIP is the state name. TANF is the federal name. The federal government awarded some grants, but these expenditures are the total grant expenditures, state and federal.
Okay.
And so you won't see any impact of federal money because it just becomes part of the total. If you looked at the state dollars, and I can provide I can point anybody who's interested to the data, because of the method of federal funding of this program, the state dollar cost of the program tends to fluctuate quite a lot, but it's an issue of the split of the state and the federal funding.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Hoffman, I think that would be valuable information, because I think often we look at this in the aggregate and we don't know how much general fund dollars are going into the MFIB or TANF program.
We have a detailed spreadsheet on the reports and forecasts webpage, which has all sorts of detail on all of these programs. And we can furnish you with the specific information, so you don't have to search through a document like that. But it is out there. We can point people to relevant pieces, or we can make those pieces available.
And, Mr. Chair, I think that would be helpful. for all of us, especially the new committee members, as we start to figure this out. I think often there's conversations around the legislature about how much money we spend in this program, and I think that I've seen members kind of look at this number in aggregate and think that that's state general fund dollars versus what it actually is. So I think, Mr. Hoffman, that would be helpful for all of the committee members.
Okay. And then Senator Benson had a question also. Staff is telling me we are starting to run a little bit behind, so we'll try to pick up the pace a little bit. But Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hoffman, with regard to the general assistance account, and please clarify my understanding. I understand it's kind of a temporary resting place for people who are waiting for Social Security disability benefits, that there's some percent of the population. Is that an accurate understanding? Because we've seen a huge spike in disability at the federal level, which might account for some of the growth and resting that we place here.
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, a substantial part of enrollment in the program, I'm not quite sure how large, but are people who have pending applications for disability, as you said. And so increasing applications for disability may have a role in the increasing numbers we see on the program.
All right. Supplemental aid.
Minnesota supplemental aid is a supplement to federal's supplemental security income payments. The typical supplement is $81 a month. We have, I believe, about 30,000 people on this program, most of them getting a supplement of that type. The trend here is basic. Not everybody on SSI gets this because of the eligibility rules for the state program. We've got a lot more people on SSI than we have on the Minnesota Supplemental Aid Program. So group residential housing is a housing benefit that serves both the elderly and the disabled, most of whom are on SSI and are placed in a setting by the county. It also serves a lesser number of people who would otherwise have general assistance eligibility who are placed by the county. And the spending trend here has been about 6.5%. With that, Mr. Chairman, that's the end of my presentation. I'll stand for questions.
Thank you. That was very, very helpful. Any additional questions for Mr. Hoffman, Mr. Johnson? All right. Thank you very much. That was incredibly helpful to me. I hope to others as well. Moving on to more of the DHS base budget programs by area type. Mr. Johnson, you're going to lead that off too and invite folks up as needed.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. I get to wear both hats in this committee. I'm going to talk about operations very briefly before I turn it over to the program areas to give you more detail on the program side of our business. You should have a page in your packet. It looks like this. Says DHS operations at the top of it, gray shaded with our little logo up in the left-hand corner. Folks finding it. Very briefly, as the name suggests, DHS operations is kind of the folks find it?
I think most folks did. Anybody not have it? I didn't.
Tell them right there.
We're good. Yep. Go ahead, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and committee members, as you might expect, DHS operations by its name, a lot of this is the backroom operations to support the department, human resources, IT, facilities, managing training, compliance, other issues such as that. And we also have within the operations area a couple of important direct program services, specifically licensing, which is an area you'll probably end up dealing a lot with in the human services business. We also have the appeals office, where we hear appeals from recipients of our services who have a concern about the way they've been treated or an action that's been taken. And also the auditing and oversight of our programs and the fraud investigation pieces also sit within operations. You can see at the bottom half of the front of this page is some of the fiscal information. When you look at the direct appropriated state funds, this is the biggest chunk of our operations, about $199 million. You can see the box shows you in all funds and breaks down where those funds come from, totaling $350 million for the biennium 14-15. This includes federal funds. A big chunk of the federal funds that are in here are for the IT side of our business. We have a very large IT operation in DHS. You can see the $240 million here that's labeled Systems Fund accounts for most of that expenditure. As I mentioned earlier, these dollars sit in the DHS budget, but they're actually under the direction and control now of Minutes. And through our CIO, who is a Minutes employee, he who sits at DHS, Tom Baden, really directs the DHS-related IT activities in concert with Central Minute and across all of the agencies. So this is part of the new world that we're in with consolidated IT. Again, the dollars still sit in the budget, so you see them here. We have a little over 1,000 employees in the operations part of the department. It's the biggest part of central office. 572 of those, are in Minutes. So they're actually not DHS employees. They're Minutes employees now. But they still sit in our building. We work with them on a daily basis and so forth. The back side of the sheet just gives you a little more detail on the functions that sit within operations. The compliance and legal office, this deals with our legal-related issues, grants and contracts, procurement, the appeals, as I mentioned earlier, piece of our agency. I mentioned Minute. We have a large IT infrastructure. A lot of that supports the actual delivery of the programs at the local level. Counties are big users of our IT infrastructure. It's an aging infrastructure. We're working on modernizing and trying, and we'll bring forward hopefully some proposals to help move that forward. The legislature asked us in 2011 to work with the counties on a plan for how we'd modernize our systems, and we're coming back with a plan for how we would do that. But these are critically important to the operation of our human services in Minnesota. And also to our how we handle all the money that flows through that we just talked about. The Office of the Inspector General, this is a new office. It was created by Commissioner Jessen in 2011, headed by Jerry Kerber, our Inspector General. It includes licensing and maltreatment investigations as well as the background studies, and also combined together a variety of the fraud and audit-related capacities that we had in different parts of the department and really put them in one place so we can really focus those efforts across the department in a comprehensive way. Chief Financial Operations Office, this is all of our financial operations from the work that Mr. Hoffman does in reporting and forecasting to the financial operations and accounting work that's done by our folks at DHS. Human Resources, we also oversee 73 county human services agencies through the Minnesota Merit System as well as the human services resources functions for our own agency. Office of Equity and Agency Development, this deals with affirmative action as well as training and internal support for the agency. Management Services, which is mostly focused on facilities, managing our facilities. We have about three or four staff that are in this little thing called County and Tribal Relations. We have a Tribal Relations Director and a County Relations Director. They're two really critically important external relationships we have with our business, and they help us focus our efforts on communication with those partners. And then, of course, the Communications Office to handle communications with them.
You mentioned some federal funds supporting the IT. I know of the Medicaid piece of that is in support of the admin function that we do to support the eligibility determinations. Is that really the lion's share of the federal funds that you were talking about, or is there other interactions?
Mr. Chair, certainly a big chunk of the funds that we get in IT are from Medicaid, but we get federal funds through any of the programs that we support that have a federal face to them. We cost allocate for the IT. Food support or SNAP is another big one where we get reimbursement on half of our administrative costs. We use some of our TANF block grant money, that is block grant money. Medicaid would be the other big one. We don't have a lot of other pieces left with AFDC going away that have the reimbursement. So Medicaid is certainly the big one.
Okay.
Any other questions on operations? Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm turning over to continuing care and Assistant Commissioner Lauren Coleman.
Who's it? Yep. Great. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question.
Yeah, Senator Franzen.
For the with regard to the DHS operations budget,
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Johnson, is he still available?
Mr. Johnson, if you could come back up. Go ahead, Senator Franzen.
A question regarding some of the IT implications for this next plan for implementation of the ACA. Are any of the one-time grants that were, I believe, granted to Minnesota and in other states, are those reflected in these figures?
Mr. Chair and Senator, the one-time grants are not reflected in our budget. Those are actually with the exchange, which sits within MMB, Minnesota Management and Budget. There are some dollars related to the exchange development because a piece of that cost of developing exchange is cost allocated to the Medicaid program. We're the Medicaid agency. We get, depending on what kind of a function is, 90 or 75% reimbursement on those expenditures. So some of that federal money does sit within the budget you were just looking at.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Coleman, continuing care.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Lauren Coleman, Assistant Commissioner for Continuing Care at DHS. As you may have observed earlier, the Continuing Care Administration is a very large component of our state budget. We administer slightly more than $3.6 billion annually in state and federal funds. And we serve approximately 350,000 Minnesotans during the course of a year. Long-term care is a range of services and supports that help people meet their health and personal needs over a long period of time. It is not medical care, although many of the people in our programs receive medical care, of course, but assistance with more basic personal tasks of everyday life, such as bathing, dressing, toileting, eating, etc. Services can be provided in community-based settings, such as a person's home, or in institutions such as nursing facilities and intermediate care facilities for developmental disability individuals. As part of our framework for the future, you'll see over the course of the next number of months a number of initiatives that are attempting to ensure that the programs are not only targeted to meet the needs of people today, but that we're planning 5 and 10 years out to be able to continue to meet the needs of people for our programs. You have an overview document. You have a number of documents that I'll reference. We're going to dive a little deeper into some of the information that Mr. Hoffman and Mr. Johnson presented. Who are we? We have four divisions within continuing care. And we're organized around aging and adult services, who has a director by the name of Gene Wood, and you'll meet these people over time if you haven't already. Deaf and hard of hearing services, led by Bruce Hodek. And disability services, the director is Alex Bartolik. And nursing facility rates and policy, Bob Held. It gives you a description on this overview of how we go about managing our programs. And again, in the interest of time, I'm not going to read what you already have in front of you. But it is important to see how the funding is distributed and some of the patterns and utilization that we have within our programs. On the overview, it shows a split between medical assistance, long-term care spending. We spend approximately 74% of our dollars on waivers or the alternatives to institutions and home care, and about 26% of our dollars are currently going to serve people within institutions. So that's on the backside of the one sheet.
Commissioner Coleman, I think we don't have that sheet in front of us.
I have that overview. Okay, so let's dive into what was just distributed to you, and that'll demonstrate it more definitively. So we have medical assistance for seniors and people with disabilities. Has the pie charts on it. On the front side, page one, again, showing the split. First, between total medical assistance spending that are covering these populations, both the elderly and people with disabilities, and the breakout between basic medical care and long-term care. And then the pie chart in the lower right, which shows the distribution within the long-term care component. And again, showing that 74% of the dollars are now being spent in the home and community-based side of our business and 26% in the institutional side. We'll get into some details of the breakout of these specific programs in a little bit. On the back side, on page two, you will see the distribution of the waiver and home care spending. Where is that 74% going to? And about 85% of the waiver and home care funding is being spent on supporting people with disabilities. And then a smaller amount for some of the other programs, but it gives you that that distribution. On the institutional side, most of the dollars being spent are on nursing facilities, but again, we have a portion of the institutional spending that is being spent on ICF DDs. I'll pause to see if there's any questions. I'll then turn to a graph that shows both projected spending as well as some historical spending. The first one is the waivers and home care. And this one includes both fee-for-service and managed care. And it shows the projections for these five fiscal years. In the bottom left-hand corner, it shows the number of persons that we anticipate serving within these programs. Let me give you some data on that to show you kind of the composition of this waiver in home care. The brain injury waiver serves approximately 1,350 people. The CAC waiver, which is the more hospital alternative, more intensive care, is our smallest of our programs, serves about 328 individuals as an alternative to hospital care. Our CADI program, community alternative for individuals with disabilities, currently serves about 16,500. Our DD, our developmental disability program, has an enrollment of about 15,500. Our elderly waiver for seniors over the age of 65 has about a little over 22,000 people currently. Some of the other programs in our home care area, we have approximately 18,000 individuals who are being supported in the community with personal care attendants. We have about 5,000 individuals who are receiving home care services and another 600 individuals who are receiving private duty nursing. So those are all of the individuals that we are serving in the community within the waivers and home care budget activity. You will see that in the bottom right-hand corner, we do project some modest growth in the expenditures per person, primarily driven by the needs of the individual. On the back side of that document, we give you some more data. We love to show you data to see where we've been and where we're going. The bottom part of the page shows you some historical perspectives of spending in our waivers and home care programs. And then on the top side of the page, it shows the projected spending. And as was indicated earlier, you have to look at this kind of in combination with the next page that we're going to review, the institutional side, because as you are well aware, there's been a shift occurring in where and how we serve people or in Minnesota over the last 25 years. Okay, we'll move to the long-term care facilities page. This includes nursing facilities and the ICFDDs. You'll see that this expenditure is pretty flat. And in fact, the number of people being served in the institutions is declining. And that is driven by policy, driven by consumer preference, driven by the products and services that facilities are offering today. So we see shorter stays. We see people preferring to stay in their homes, in their community, and our goal is to try to help that become a reality for as many who choose that. We also see, though, some, again, modest increase in payment per person, driven by need, and we will continue to see the people served in institutions being some of the higher need individuals within our long-term care programs. The back side of that page, again, the same snapshot of how we project expenditures for over the five-year period and the historical perspective of what has been occurring over the last 6 years. I don't know if the graphs are so complete that it answers everything you want to know or if it's too much. So you also have...
I'm sort of looking for the graph that you're talking about. That's what I think it's hard to get where you're at.
Okay,
in terms of
my apologies. It is a trend line in your packet on facilities, labeled facilities. Don't have it?
We don't have
it. My apologies.
I think, just to answer your question, Madam Chair, if I may.
You may.
I just am saying when my lack of questions anyway are related to sort of struggling to figure out what you're referencing here. So I might have had some questions, but I'm hardly listening. I'm desperately looking for the materials. So.
Again, my apologies. I would invite you when we appear again. We certainly will try to answer your questions and provide the proper documentation, as well as always will be available if you have an interest in meeting at another time to review some of the documents.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, I just, I've not quite seen Mr. In regards to the, it's this particular graph. It's another one that looked like that.
Correct.
Okay, and on the back side, there's a historical summary box, and but it has percent change in persons. That's pretty straightforward. Then the change in the average monthly cost and the percent change in total payments. Can you just give a little explanation briefly on the interplay of those three?
Commissioner?
certainly. On the institutional side, we are seeing fewer people being served in this setting because people are preferring to live in the community. But the people who are remaining in the institutional sector typically have higher needs. So their expenditures will go up because the payments are based on an acuity-based model, so that if their needs are higher, the payments to facilities would tend to go up.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Well, let's try the next set of documents to see if they're in your packets. We have some descriptions of some of the other programs within continuing care. The first one that I'll draw your attention to is alternative care. The alternative care program is a state-funded program, which again has the goal of helping people remain in their homes. It's one of our lower-cost programs, and it's intended to serve people who otherwise would spend down, exhaust their resources, and have to go on medical assistance. We think it's a valuable program. We do believe that it saves the state money because of its cost structure, as well as we believe it saves the federal government money. So I'll reference that in that we have requested the federal government to participate in this program. It is part of our Reform 2020 and waiver submission reform package that has already been submitted to the federal government. We don't have an answer yet from the federal government about their participation, but is part of our discussions with the federal government. We serve approximately 4,600 individuals to help them remain in their homes. And it has a list of the kinds of services that people can receive as part of this program. Okay. The next document is Aging and Adult Services Grants. Again, this program serves a number of people today in very low-cost manners, but is also intended to make sure that we have a service structure that will accommodate the age wave, the number of future older Minnesotans. You can see that we have a variety of strategies to do so. Some of these programs are administered through the Minnesota Board on Aging, and some of them are therefore administered through the Area Agencies on Aging, which are in the community around the state, a network of organizations. You can see that we have quite a bit of activity around nutrition, congregate meals, home-delivered meals, delivering groceries to a limited number of individuals who otherwise would have difficulties remaining in their homes. We have other programs, community service development grants, where we work with provider organizations to deliver services to older Minnesotans. We have evidence-based health promotion, chronic disease management, again, a prevention theme, trying to help people remain as independent as long as possible. A lot of these programs are very community-based, very volunteer-oriented. We depend upon neighbors, friends, families to help support people remain in their homes. Additionally, within this activity, we have the Senior Linkage Line, the one-stop shop, which is trying to deliver good information to older Minnesotans and their families on how to access services, whether they're on a public program or not. We want people to have good information. It's one of the key strategies to help people during the latter part of the year select Medicare Part D insurance plans, to be able to call the linkage lines and get good counseling and information. Part of what we manage through here is also the return to community, which is a very specific program to help individuals who are in nursing facilities who express a desire to return to community and need some additional support to accomplish that goal. Many people return the community on their own with friends, families, but some need some additional supports. We will also manage the Central Community Support Program through this activity when we implement the nursing facility level of care. The Central Community Support Program is a low-cost program that will, again, help people remain in their homes. Another component of the Continuing Care Administration is deaf and hard of hearing services.
Mr. Chairman, I just had a quick question.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Coleman, I noticed on the budget category, and maybe this was explained and I'm just now I'm focused on this, but Aging and Adult Services was 24,609 in the 12-13 and then went up. It's such a significant jump, 82.7%. So maybe there's another changing of funds or temporary things happening.
Mr. Chair, Senator, there's basically two explanations for why there's such a significant change. One is some of the aging and adult grants have been suspended, so we have not been administering some of those funds. But the major explanation for this is the essential community supports, which is not needed right now because we have not implemented the nursing facility level of care. They'll be implemented January 1, 2014. So then the essential community supports funding becomes available. So that's why there's such a jump. There's a corresponding savings by implementing nursing facility level of care, but that doesn't appear in this particular budget activity.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Deaf and hard of hearing services is a division of continuing care. And this is attempting to support people who are deaf, hard of hearing, deaf blind, again, remain in the community, be as independent as possible. We have a list of activities here that this division administers. We have a mental health program for people who are deaf and hard of hearing and deaf-blind that is directly administered through this division. We have a telephone distribution program, an equipment distribution program, where individuals can receive equipment to help them communicate while they are living in the community. We have a national deafblind equipment distribution program. This is relatively new that we were able to apply for and be selected. It's small in scope, but for people who are deafblind, it's very important. And then a number of grant programs where we work through agencies to provide services throughout Minnesota. We administer these programs through regional offices. We have several regional offices throughout Minnesota that we use to connect with people in the community. On the back side of that page, it'll give you some scope of how many people we are touching in a given year through the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Division. Great. Disability grants. Again, we have a variety of grants where the goal is, again, to help people remain as independent as possible. And again, in the interest of time, I won't read what you have in front of you, but we have the family support grants, the consumer support grants, the SILS, or the semi-independent living services. We have programs for individuals who have HIV/AIDS. We have the disability linkage line. Okay, you're still looking for your pages. We've not done a good job in collating this.
Well,
I think,
is there another topic to cover or not? Is this the last one?
This is the last page.
Okay. Well, why don't you just finish describing it, and we'll make photocopies of that and have it for members. They can catch up.
The disability linkage line is, again, comparable to the senior linkage line, but has more specificity to services that would be of interest to and necessary for people with disabilities, the under 65 population, to have good consumer information. And it gives some data on this sheet when you receive it. We had about 45,000 contacts with people with disabilities in the past year. So it's a very busy telephone line. Housing access services, also a budget activity in this arena, where we are helping people who express an interest in moving into their own apartments from institutions or from group homes. And to date, we have moved, helped over 600 people move into apartments and homes of their own. We believe it's a valuable service to those individuals who have that as their goal. And there's some smaller grants within this activity that that again are trying to help people be self-advocates, help people who have some very specific needs, such as epilepsy, remain as independent and have choices within their communities. So with that, that is a quick summary of what continuing care does.
And kept us right on schedule. You had 25 minutes and used about 26. We're in good shape. Any questions for Mr. Coleman? All right. Thank you very much for that. And we'll move on to Children and Family Services. The Children and Family Services is a handout in your packet. Welcome, Ms. Sutton Sullivan.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Erin Sullivan Sutton. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services. Yes, I like to say I was Irish first.
Okay.
What I'm going to do is give you a high-level overview of the programs and funding in the Children and Family Services area. Using this document to guide us through the discussion, feel free to ask any questions as we go through, but I will keep this very high level for the sake of time. The Children and Family Services works with counties and tribes and community organizations to help low-income families and children achieve economic stability through a number of work support programs, such as the Minnesota Family Investment Program, the Diversionary Work Program, child support, child care, food support, and other public assistance programs that I'll go into in more detail. And the second primary thing we do is we have responsibility for managing the state's child welfare system, which includes children and families who are reported for abuse and neglect, children in foster care, and children whose parental rights have been terminated. We have direct responsibility to help assure that those children have the opportunity for permanent legal families, either with relatives or through adoptive families. On that first page, you also see the admitted operations systems that support the programs that we administer that Mr. Johnson mentioned that are operated by Admitted Services. They're the MAXIS system, MAC squared, which is child care, PRISM is child support, and then finally the social service information system. The next couple of pages are just some high-level summaries of the funding in Children and Family Services. The first chart that you have is direct appropriated all funds. As Commissioner Justin indicated, the Children and Family Services is about 11% of all department funds, and you can see that there. We also have about 64% of the non-forecasted funds. The next chart, and I won't go into this a lot of detail because Mr. Johnson and Mr. Hoffman did, is a chart of direct appropriated funds. Again, here you can see that Children and Family Services is about 9% of the all funds in forecast. Moving on to the next couple of pages, Children and Family Services administers a number of federal block grants that are provided to states, and the federal block grants allow states to have some flexibility within a broad range of program goals and purposes to meet the needs of the individuals within our states. We operate four of the major federal block grants. The first is the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. That's about $263 million per year. That provides funding to help support our Minnesota Family Investment Program that I'll mention or talk more about in a few minutes. And you can see here there are certain designated purposes of the TANF funds that states have discretion in using. We also have a significant maintenance of effort requirement of $176 to $188 million per year based on whether or not we meet our work participation rates. And you hear a lot about the work participation rates in the TANF program. We also administer the Child Care Development Fund, which is just over $81 million per year. And this supports provides assistance for child care for families who are on our public programs or who meet certain eligibility requirements. We also administer Title 20, the Social Services Block Grant Fund, which is about $29 million per year. This provides states funding for a broad array of social services. However, the Minnesota legislature in the past couple of years directed that these funds be used to serve vulnerable adults and children when you pass the Vulnerable Children and Adult Fund Act. We also administer the Community Services Block Grant, which is just over $8 million per year. These funds go to the community action agencies across the state to provide a number of support programs for low-income families and individuals that I'll talk more about in a few moments. The next five pages, what you have are summary of the CFS forecast programs and some data around those programs that I won't go into in a lot of detail because Mr. Hoffman talked to you about those already. But you can see we start out with the MFIP, the diversionary work, which is the cash and food spending. On the left side of the page is a description of the program as well as some data in terms of caseloads on the right side of the page. Secondly, we have the Minnesota Family Investment and Transition Year Child Care Assistance. We have three child care assistance programs in the state. One is for families that are on the Minnesota Family Investment Program. The second is for families who exit the program that can remain on transition year child care for a year. And then the third program is the basic sliding fee, which is not a forecasted program, but it's child care that's available for people who meet certain eligibility requirements that I will talk about in a few minutes. And then the next couple of pages, again, are the forecasted programs that Mr. Hoffman talked to you about, so I won't go into those in any detail unless you have questions. And then starting on page 12, I'll go into more detail about the programs within Children and Family Services. The first, starting with the child welfare area in the Division of Child Safety and Permanency, we have responsibility for providing direction to counties and two tribes in the administration of child welfare services. We have responsibility for ensuring safety, permanency, and well-being for children who I mentioned are reported to be at risk of abuse and neglect. That's about 25,000 children per year are subjects of maltreatment reports. We also have responsibility for children who are in foster care. I will note that the number of children in foster care has been reduced by about 40% over the past 10 years, in large part due to reforms in our child protection system to assure that kids can remain safely at home whenever possible. And we also have responsibility for providing services for youth who are transitioning from foster care to young adulthood. At the bottom of that page, you can also see that we have responsibility for administering a number of smaller federal programs in this area, including the Title IV-E Foster Care and Adoption Assistance, the Foster Care Independence Program, and we also provide education and training vouchers for youth who've been in foster care and are pursuing post-secondary education, and then a number of smaller child welfare, child abuse prevention and treatment services. On the next page, I mentioned a number of reforms in the child welfare area. Over the past decade, we've implemented a family assessment response to responding to families who are reported to our state's child welfare system, which is a strength-based approach to helping families meet the safety needs of their children. We also have responsibility for a statewide training system in the area of child welfare and quality assurance. So we review local county and tribal child welfare agencies to help assure that they are meeting federal outcome performance measures to the extent that they are able to. Moving on to the child support area. In order to receive federal TANF funds, which support our infant program, states must operate a child support program in compliance with federal plan requirements. The child support program provides a number of services to help ensure that resources go to children. We work with counties to establish paternity for children. About 181,000 children who have a Minnesota child support case were born outside of marriage. It's important to note. We work with counties and others to establish child support orders, including medical support orders, to assure that children receive the care that they need. And we also work to assure that parents are located, and we work to collect and disperse child support collections. And you can see there the number of dollars that we collect in child support, just over $600 million. We also work with counties and county attorneys to enforce child support orders through a variety of mandated enforcement remedies that I've noted there that you can review. And on the next page is just some more statistics regarding our child support collections. I will note that we had a steady increase in collections from state fiscal year 2000 to 2009. We saw a slight decrease in 2010 to 2012. We believe that's mostly attributable to unemployment and non-custodial parents having reduced earnings. And you can see there the program funding. It's about county, the share is about 24% or $41 million. State's about 15%, $15 million or 9%, and federal about $116 million or 67%. The federal government pays about two-thirds of the cost of child support. The next area I want to talk about briefly is the Child Care Assistance Program and the Child Development Services. The Child Care Assistance Program is funded through a mixture of federal grants, the Child Care Development Fund, TANF, and State General Fund, and County Match. The Child Care Development Fund is a federal program that supports low-income families through quality child care assistance and promotes learning by improving the quality of early child care and education and after-school programs. And I should mention here that we work very closely with the Department of Education as well as the Department of Health to try to increase the number of low-income children, children from low-income families, having access to high-quality care. The state law also provides direction on Child Care Assistance Program and the Child Care Resource and Referral Network, which is a network of agencies across the state to help parents find information about locating quality child care. And we also have responsibility for a promoting a professional development system for early childhood as well as school-age child care providers. The federal and state funding for child care assistance totaled just over $200 million in state fiscal year 2012, and about $10.6 million of that is to promote high-quality child care. I should also note that there were significant reductions to the child care assistance program occurred in 2003, and you will hear a number of your constituents talk about the low rates the child care assistance program pays to providers. The maximum rates to providers under the CCAP program may not cover the full cost of care because the rates are not based on current market rate. And, in fact, the percent of child care provider rates that are fully covered by the program has worsened since 2003. At that time, the rates covered about 75% of the providers. Now we pay about just under 25% of the current rate. I should also note that Minnesota received a $45 million in the federal Race to the Top Learning Challenge Grant for calendar year 2012 and 2015 to improve access to high-quality care. And a large part of this grant is helping us with a statewide rollout of a quality improvement system, which is known as Parent Aware.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Question. For child care, can you talk a little bit about age groups, how many students? Or how many children, rather, are enrolled in these programs by age?
So if you go to page 9, in the child care development grant, there's some data in terms of the number of children who are cared for in licensed child care settings. I can also tell you that for the children receiving child care assistance, about 16% are in the 0 to 1 year category. Almost 25%, 24.9%, are ages 2 to 3. 23.4% are ages 4 to 5. And 35.3% are 6 to 12-year-olds. And 0.3% are 13 and 14-year-olds.
Thank you.
Back to page 17, then, is where we're...
Page 17.
Great.
So as I mentioned, the child care is available as a forecasted program for individuals who are on the Minnesota Family Investment Program or transitioning for a period of 1 year. The basic sliding fee program is a capped allocation which provides child care subsidies for families at or under 47% of the state median income, which is $33,786 at the program entry. Those funds are allocated on a county-by-county basis. Because the counties bear the risk of having to pay, if they overspend on basic sliding fee, they have to use the county funds to pay for it. So we have waiting lists on the basic sliding fee, and that varies from county to county. That's an issue that you probably have heard about from your constituents as well. Families can continue to receive subsidies under the basic sliding fee until they exceed 67% of the state median income, which is just over $48,000 a year. And then families have to pay co-pays based on their income and family size. 18,160 families received on a monthly basis received child care assistance with an average payment of $891. I should also note that we pay up to 15% higher of the maximum rate for providers who meet certain accreditation standards or education standards that are founded in law. In the area of child development services, this is the area that we're really working across the state and with the Department of Education and providers to improve quality and help parents access information about child care that are focused on increasing the quality of care and education in early childhood and school-age care settings. And implementing a quality rating and improvement system that I mentioned, which is known as Parent Aware. There was a pilot that was done a couple of years ago. We're now expanding this availability of quality rating system over a period through 2014 across the state. We also provide families and communities with information, as I mentioned, through our child care resource and referral services. And we have responsibility for growing a competent, skilled early childhood and school-age care through provision of training, mentoring, and coaching, and a professional development system and registry throughout the state. The next area I want to talk about briefly is work support programs that we have responsibility for. We have responsibility for primarily three work support programs. One is the Minnesota Family Investment Program. Second is the Diversionary Work Program, and third is the Work Benefit Program. All three of those programs are administered by the County Human Service Agencies, and the Mille Lacs Band also administers their own MFIP program. The county agencies work with the workforce centers or nonprofit agencies to help people move from assistance to jobs. The Minnesota Family Investment Program provides temporary assistance for low-income families with one or more children under age 18 or 19 if in school, and to women who are pregnant, as Mr. Hoffman indicated. The MFIP program includes job counseling, cash, food assistance through the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and child care assistance. Longest period of time people can be on the program is a total of 60 months. Most families get off the program within 2 years, and there are some families who, because of disability, may be extended beyond that 60 months. On this page, what you have is some more detail about the program. MFIP provides assistance to families up to 115% of the federal poverty guideline. The grants are a combination of the federal TANF money I mentioned, state general fund. And you can see there in state fiscal year 2012, the average monthly cases were just over 36,000, and there's a $319 million annual payment, which includes about $166 million in federal food support. The Diversionary Work Program is a program that's work-focused, and it, when people come in to apply for assistance, if they recently lost employment, they're placed on the Diversionary Work Program that includes intensive upfront services to focus on family strengths and break down barriers to finding employment. This program is provided for a period of 4 months. The idea is to really help people get into employment. Services are vendor paid, and people who are on the diversionary work, it does not count towards their 60-month work lifetime limit. And then we have the Work Benefit Program, which is provides a cash benefit of $25 a month for families who are exiting MFIP and that meet certain work requirements for up to 24 consecutive months. Now, I will mention that one of the reasons that this program was created is the work participation rates that I mentioned earlier help us meet federal compliance requirements. And what the work participation rate measures is whether or not families are engaged in any of, I think it's 14 eligible activities, which may or may not lead to employment. Families who actually get jobs and leave the program aren't counted under the program. And so this program was created in Minnesota so that we can count these families who actually get jobs so that we can continue to meet our federal requirements. So a lot of creativity has gone into our public assistance programs to help us meet federal compliance standards. I should also mention that over half of the parents on both MFIP and diversionary work were employed in the quarter before they turned to assistance. So most of these families are very similar to other people who lose jobs. It's simply that because of their circumstance, they're not eligible for unemployment insurance, and they turn to our programs. I should also mention that 70% of the 70% of the people on these programs are children. On page 21 is just a couple of more statistics. You can take a glance at this in more detail. I won't read all of this to you, but I do want to note that of all the MFIP cases, 51% of the MFIP individuals started with an adolescent birth, and that's something that you'll see us talk more about, is trying to get a handle on reducing adolescent births, but also making sure that we are intervening in these situations differently to try to address some of the intergenerational poverty issues. The next area I want to turn to quickly is the Federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or the SNAP program. This is the program that helps Minnesotans with low incomes get the food they need for sound nutrition and well-balanced meals. This is 100% federally funded. The way that this program operates is that there are SNAP benefits are available to people through electronic benefit. Benefits in Minnesota totaled $668 million in state fiscal year 2011, and the average monthly benefit is $245 monthly. Over half of the recipients are children under age 18, and 40% of the households participating in SNAP are families with minor children. Earlier, you saw that there's been an increase in expenditure in the SNAP program. That's primarily due to increase in the number of people who are eligible. There's been also an awful lot of work done through a Nutritious Food Coalition, which was convened by the Lieutenant Governor a year ago, which is particularly focused on encouraging seniors who may be eligible to sign up and apply, because less than 50% of the seniors who are eligible are actually on the program. We want to make sure that seniors don't have to make difficult choices between nutrition, health care, and housing and the like. The next area I want to turn to quickly is the Community Action and the Office of Economic Opportunity. We provide a number of community-based services to support families and individuals to help them fulfill their basic needs for food, clothing, shelter, and attain skills and knowledge that will result in their becoming self-sufficient. These funds are directed to community action agencies throughout the state. We administer the Community Services Block Grant that I mentioned earlier. And you can read more in detail. I just want to draw your attention to the second bullet towards the bottom. Some of the programs that are administered through the Community Action Agency include Head Start, Energy Assistance, Weatherization, Emergency Services, Food Support Outreach, Nutrition, and Senior Programs. We also operate the Family Assets for Independence in Minnesota, which helps low-income families begin savings in developing their assets so that they can purchase homes, start businesses, and further their education, as well as support their financial literacy. We also work with the Emergency Food Assistance Program and the Food Shelf Program and do SNAP outreach and SNAP education. The Emergency Food Assistance Program, otherwise known as TFAP, distributes commodities provided by the Department of Agriculture to individuals and families using on-site meals, food shelves, and food shelters. And we also contract with Hunger Solution in Minnesota to allocate commodities based on population and poverty data throughout the state. The Office of Economic Opportunity also administers a number of homeless programs and shelter programs for low-income individuals as well as youth. We administer the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act and provide transitional housing emergency services for runaway and homeless youth. And you can see the data on the bottom of page 25 in terms of the number of individuals who are served through the community action agencies. Last couple of programs I want to mention to you are the other public assistance programs. First is the General Assistance Program. Mr. Hoffman mentioned this in his forecasted program. The General Assistance Program is the primary safety net for single adults and childless married couples who are unable to work. And as Mr. Hoffman indicated, the General Assistance, the benefit level is $203 a month. Individuals must meet one of 15 eligibility criteria, and income and assets have to be verified. And you can see more detail about that. We also have general assistance for people who are in residential facilities, and the benefit level there is $89 a month. And that's a personal needs allowance. The next program I want to mention briefly is the Minnesota Supplemental Aid Program, which is the state-funded program that provides monthly cash supplement to people who are aged, blind, or disabled, and who receive the federal supplemental security income benefits. This was a program that was also in the forecast that was presented by Mr. Hoffman. This program allows special need payments to qualified participants for medically prescribed diets, representative payee services, guardian or conservator fees, and non-recurring home repairs. There you can see the benefit level is $81 a month, and the shelter needy is $955 a month plus food support. And last but not least is the group residential housing program, which is a state-funded income supplement program that pays for room and board costs for elderly or low-income adults with disabilities who are living in licensed or registered community-based settings throughout the state. The GRH rate is average is $846 a month, and clients must be eligible for SSI or general assistance to be eligible for group residential housing. They are age, blind, or over 18 and disabled. In 2011, the average monthly participation was just over 18,000 people who were on the GRH program, and the average monthly payment was actually $530. And with that, I'll be happy to take any questions. I know you're running out of time.
Yeah, well, I'm actually out of breath just listening to you for that 30 minutes. Any questions of members? Seeing none, we'll adjourn a little early. Thank you, Ms. Sullivan Sutton.
Thank you.
Irish first. Okay, I'll work on that. And members, thank you for your participation. I think this was a good start. And the Health and Human Services Finance Committee stands adjourned.